The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, just send your email to td@kpcg.fm. Later on in the program, segment two, we'll be looking at some of the statistics. We didn't get to those yesterday, but some of the stats from this past weekend for the TV program that played in the UK. Well, in recent programs, we've been stressing just how fast prophetic events are now moving in Europe. I can only imagine what the late trumpet columnist Ron Fraser would be writing about right now, given what's happening in Europe. He really did have some deep insights into this particular region. And of course, he was educated in the prophecies of God, like so many of us. We've had, of course, a lot of others, a lot of young men, in fact, that have really worked hard to fill the void that Mr. Fraser's death left in 2013. But if he were still here today, he'd be telling you about just how fast events are moving. Look at what's been happening just this year, and how that's now punctuated in so many ways by the attack from last Friday night in Paris. The New York Times today talked about how different the climate is right now, even compared to January. I mean, in January, that was a horrific attack as well at the Charlie Hebdo headquarters. But it says here in the New York Times, unlike the response in January, after attacks at the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo and elsewhere left 17 dead, there were no grand public appeals for solidarity with Muslims after the Friday attacks that left 129 dead in Paris. There were no marches, few pleas not to confuse practitioners of Islam with those who preach jihad. Instead, I mean, that's what there was in January. People immediately rising in defense of Islam. Marches, people pleading for peace. The New York Times now says instead, regarding this latest attack, there was a palpable fear, even anger, as President Francois Hollande asked Parliament to extend a state of emergency and called for changing the Constitution to deal with terrorism. It was largely unspoken, but nevertheless clear. Secular France always had a complicated relationship with its Muslim community, but now it was tipping toward outright distrust, even hostility. This time around, in other words, it's different. November is not January. This time around, we're hearing a lot of tough talk coming from officials that are really in a pretty liberal government. Leaders in France are calling for more scrutiny on mosques, more restrictions on the 10,000 or so people who are considered to be possible threats in France. We read there about the state of emergency the president wants to extend. France needs to expel all these radicalized imams. That's what Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared over the weekend. We've got to get rid of them all of the ones that have been radicalized. The Times writes, the grim public mood, with hardened jaws and frowns on the emptied streets, is bubbling up deep shades of distinction that previously separated France's political groupings, left, right, and far right, on how to handle the terrorist threat, or even how to deal with France's large Muslim community. They're blurring. They're blurring these deep shades of distinction. We touched on this briefly yesterday. Switching now to Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Notice what he said, again, regarding France's angry response to what happened Friday night. Pritchard says France has invoked emergency powers to sweep aside EU deficit rules and retake control over its economy after the terrorist atrocities in Paris, pledging a massive increase in security and defense spending, whatever the cost. I mean, when have you heard this? A Western nation saying that it's time for massive increases in military spending. It's time for a massive military buildup. And in fact, we're going to invoke emergency powers and sweep aside all of the EU rules because we are at war. The article says President François Hollande said vital interests of the French nation are at stake and there can be no further justification for narrowly legalistic deficit rules imposed by Brussels. The security pact takes precedence over the stability pact. France, he said, is at war. France is at war. And so all the defense cuts that had been planned, they've been canceled. They've been canceled because France is unleashing a campaign to eradicate ISIS, it says. The article says at least 17,000 people will be recruited to beef up the security apparatus and the Interior Ministry, fast becoming the nerve center of the country's all-encompassing war against the ISIS network. Hollande also announced that France will invoke the European Mutual Defense Clause. This article that states if one member state is the victim of armed aggression on its sovereign territory, then the other member states have an obligation to assist, to provide aid and support. Here again, all of this is consistent with what the president has said over the weekend and in front of Parliament, that France is at war, that France is fighting against an army of terrorists, an army that's operating from abroad, an army that's infiltrated the European Union and France's borders. And isn't it interesting that France is turning to the EU for military help and assistance? Not NATO. They're not looking for a U.S.-led NATO campaign. They're turning to the EU. They're ignoring the United States. These European leaders that are so outspoken all of a sudden, they see what's happened to America. They see what President Obama's policies have done to the Middle East. They see an American power in retreat. They see leadership in Washington that's talked about the global war on terrorism being over, that says Al-Qaeda was decimated. Al-Qaeda's on the run. And all these new affiliates, ISIS, for example, well, it's just an amateurish JV team, that's all. As recently as July 2014, the president of the United States claimed that the world was less violent than it's ever been. It's more tolerant. You've heard some of these quotes before on this program. The world's always been a little bit messy, and social media just draws more attention to it today than the technologies or the more primitive technologies would have centuries ago. And here since that time, well, we've seen the large territory that ISIS has been gaining. You think about, we'll have to break this down a little bit more, perhaps tomorrow. I just didn't have time really to go through that press conference. That was either Monday or yesterday. President Obama, or I guess Monday is yesterday, but President Obama talking to the press there in that G20 conference in Turkey, but he made this statement that he's not interested in pursuing some notion of American leadership or America winning. He's not interested in that. And so do you think the French president's going to turn to him for help? Do you think the European Union is going to turn to the United States for leadership during this crisis? I mean, after 7 years in office, America still won't even really address the religious component to these violent attacks. And really, that's because the belief from President Obama right on down the line is that all of this conflict, it arises from a misunderstanding or from colonialism or from George Bush's leadership before him. But the reason it's important prophetically is because of what I read to you yesterday, Daniel 11, verse 40, talking about that clash, talking about radical Islam pushing and pushing. And then the king of the north, the European power, coming against it like a whirlwind. And the United States, as my father said years ago on the Key of David, the United States not even mentioned in this prophecy. And so these European leaders, they, as weak and as liberal as some of them are, there's new leadership coming to Europe, as we've been discussing. But even some of these liberal left-wing leaders, they've been jolted. They've been jolted. They're rising up. They're declaring war. They see that the United States has left the Middle East. They see the United States as weak, unwilling to confront the enemy. And so you have the leader of France, as I say, turning to the EU for support, for help, for assistance. Look at the impact this is having on Germany as well. Germany's now reconsidering its foreign policy, its approach, whether or not to intervene at hotspots with a stronger show of force. The Wall Street Journal said, the Paris attacks have jolted Germany into considering greater military involvement in the fight against the Islamic State, despite public opposition to abandoning its largely pacifist foreign policy. Well, even the public opposition, we're seeing some of that diminished. The voices raising the prospect of military intervention by the European Union's biggest country came largely from Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative group in Parliament. This article talks about Germany looking into expanding its mission in Iraq, where they've already trained thousands of fighters and supplied them with 20,000 firearms, 20,000 hand grenades, as well as millions of rounds of ammunition. The journal says the violent aftermath of U.S.-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, coupled with the long shadow of World War II, has made military deployments unpalatable to most Germans. But in the general public and in Berlin's political and think tank circles, both, in the general public and in Berlin's political and think tank circles, but all of that's changing. It says here, the massacre in Paris has shocked a nation that has never itself suffered a major Islamist terror attack. It hasn't happened yet in Germany. Not a major one. But this attack in Paris, coupled with the conflict in Ukraine and the stream of refugees and migrants, the attacks underscored the global security crisis. Crises can hit uncomfortably close to home. See, this is really close to home, the way the Germans view it. The Telegraph had a piece today about how the Paris attacks change everything. This, according to a senior German politician. The article's about the Bavarian finance minister, Marcus Söder is his name, and he's been quite critical of Merkel's open-door policy. He's come out and said Germany needs to protect its borders. He said Paris changes everything. Notice this piece. This is the Telegraph. High-profile German politicians have insisted on linking Friday's mass killings, which claimed at least 129 lives and injured 352. They've insisted on linking this with the country's influx of refugees, raising fears over who exactly are among the 1 million asylum seekers expected to arrive in Germany by the end of the year. How can you know? It's like that quote from Nigel Farage we played yesterday. Even if it's just 1%, even if it's less than 1%. Look at what a small band of heavily armed terrorists can do to terrorize an entire city, an entire nation. It says Mr. Söder, a member of the Christian Social Union, or CSU, which has been highly critical of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's open-door policy, said Germany must secure its own borders if the EU fails to toughen up its external frontiers, echoing warnings from Horst Seehofer, the Bavarian state premier. Not every refugee, notice this, not every refugee is an IS terrorist, but to believe that not a single civil war fighter is among the refugees is naive. France shows that in questions of security, we cannot make any more compromises. This changes everything. Paris changes everything, he's saying. The article continues, Germany confirmed on Saturday that it has toughened up border controls with France following the attacks. And then later it emerged on Sunday that Germany will bolster its fight against terrorism by hiring an additional 225 staff for its foreign intelligence agency. So they're picking up more spies. Same with France, because they've got to track these killers. They've got to find them before they carry out these dreadful acts of terror. I just want to refer you again to, I think this was a quote within an article I read yesterday, this commentary by Marcus Feldenkirchen. He's a German journalist. And an article I read to you yesterday quoted from this piece, just a little snippet, but I went back and looked at it today, the entirety of this article, the original article by Feldenkirchen. And it is astounding. And all the more so because of when it was written, November the 12th, the day before the Paris attacks, the day before the Paris massacre. And this German journalist, he spent a couple of years in the United States on assignment, and then he comes back to Germany. This is just after 2 years. He just returns to Germany recently, and he's thinking to himself, what has happened to my nation? What a change. The article says Germany could approach the refugee crisis without surrendering its civility, but instead the basest of anti-foreigner sentiment is taking hold in many places. If it continues, we could soon witness an atmosphere of brutality not seen in decades. That's what he observed, even before these Paris attacks. Just 2 years away. 2 years in America. And he comes back and his nation had changed dramatically. He mentions a few examples, this chairman of the right-wing AfD party, how he said that Germany's borders needed to be protected using force if necessary, shooting those who came across illegally, in other words. He mentioned this other example of a mayoral candidate who was stabbed recently because of her refugee policies. He talked about the incident with 30 Germans beating up these Syrian refugees with baseball bats. He writes, it's a country where the language used to foment against foreigners, both on the ground and online, makes even Donald Trump's tirades against immigrants seem harmless. What if a charismatic German leader comes along with a Trump-like stance on borders and security? Do you think that would be well received among the German people today? Considering the current political climate, do you think a charismatic leader who comes along and says, that's enough, no more refugees, no more immigrants, not for now anyway, we've got to secure our borders, we've got to vet those who are already here, we've got to make sure that we protect ourselves. This German journalist, again, this is Marcus Feldenkirchen, he asks, what has happened to Germany? Does the sudden influx of hundreds of thousands of refugees justify forgetting almost everything that used to be important to us? The refugee crisis is, of course, a challenge. Solving it will take time, money, and energy. But Germany has all the resources it needs. This is his opinion, of course, and I think he comes more from the left wing. In any event, he says, but Germany has all the resources it needs to manage this crisis without surrendering its civility. Instead, the mood in the country is akin to a drunken rage of the kind last seen in the beer halls of the 1920s Weimar Republic, that period of crude, uncivilized behavior that paved the way for Hitler's rise and the most brutal decade in world history. This is one man's view. He's on the ground in Germany. Here is one commentator's view of Germany today. The title of his piece is A Brutal New Germany. What's happening to my country? A brutal new Germany is here. In his view, and it's shocking. He says here, finally, then too, criticism and anxiety wasn't put forth in the form of discourse. It was expressed in the form of fistfights on the streets. This is talking about the 1920s. We know today that this culture of brutality played a considerable role in the failure of Germany's first attempt at democracy. Ultimately, the loud and the brutal severed society's vulnerable ties. We're obviously not anywhere close to that point today. Those threatening our society today are not in the majority, but there is still a large number of them. The Federal Republic of Germany established a functioning democracy in the decades after Hitler, and its people had good reasons to be proud of the country's political culture. But no one should take it as a certainty that this achievement is safe forever. That's the bit that we quoted yesterday. We shouldn't just assume that this will always be the case. This post-war, democratic, pacifist nation. Again, what is it that's embedded into the DNA of Germany, as we've been discussing in recent programs? What has been the history? We're experiencing some dramatic changes. November is not January. Herbert Armstrong wrote back in the 1980s, when this Holy Roman Empire does happen, it will happen suddenly, so quickly it will take your breath. Are we in the early stages of that sudden transformation? It says the whole world will gasp in awe and wonder when they see the things that are prophesied. For example, 10 nations in Europe, probably 5 of them in Western Europe and 5 in Eastern Europe, reviving, resurrecting the so-called Holy Roman Empire of the Middle Ages. He wrote that in 1981. And look at his credentials. Talk about a student of prophecy. It's this man's writings that Ron Fraser and others like him immerse themselves into. If you go back farther to April 1952, Mr. Armstrong's Good News magazine, there was this statement, Russia may give East Germany back to the Germans. and will be forced to relinquish her control over Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and parts of Austria to complete the 10-nation union. That's Herbert Armstrong writing in 1952, right at what you could consider a peak in the Cold War with the Soviet Union that was a superpower, saying that, well, eventually Russia's going to have to give back Germany, East Germany. Eventually, Russia's going to lose control of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and so on. Did that happen? He was spot on with that forecast, because it was based in prophecy. It was based in God's word. Notice what he said in 1955. Some of the Balkan nations are going to tear away from behind the Iron Curtain. Russia probably will lose still more of her Eastern European satellites. Well, Mr. Armstrong had so many prophecies, so many very specific prophetic predictions, just like that. And look at where we are today. When it happens, it's going to happen suddenly. It'll take your breath away. The whole world is going to gasp in awe and wonder when they see these things that are prophesied happening. Well, you look at what's happening in Europe. The mood in Europe right now is dark. The mood is dark. France is at war with the Islamic State. And there are commentators now in Germany asking, what is happening in Germany? What we see today is a brutal new Germany. Well, and then look at Islam, radical Islam. Do you think they're going to be getting great gains from all of this as Europe rises up? This is from the Washington Post. November 15th. This is by a counterterrorism analyst who works at the Institute for the Study of War. And she says the Islamic State strategy is to polarize Western society, to destroy the gray zone, as it says in its publications. The group hopes frequent devastating attacks in its name will provoke overreactions by European governments against innocent Muslims, thereby alienating and radicalizing Muslim communities throughout the continent. So what they hope for here, following on this attack in Paris, is for an overreaction. They're hoping for their fellow Muslims, the more moderate ones, they're hoping that they will be alienated or perhaps targeted. It says the atrocities in Paris are only the most recent instances of this accelerating campaign. Since January, European citizens fighting with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria have provided online and material support to lethal operations in Paris, Copenhagen, and near Lyon, France, as well as attempted attacks in London, Barcelona, and near Brussels. Islamic State fighters are likely responsible for destroying the Russian airliner over the Sinai. I think that's been pretty much confirmed now by U.S. and U.K. and Russian authorities. But she says here, these attacks are not random, nor are they aimed primarily at affecting Western policy in the Middle East. They are rather part of a militarily capable organization's campaign to mobilize extremist actors already in Europe, and to recruit new ones. With each new attack, you see, it pulls in more recruits. The strategy is explicit, the article says. The Islamic State explained after January's attacks on Charlie Hebdo that such attacks compel the crusaders to actively destroy the gray zone themselves. That's quoting from an Islamist publication. It says, quoting this publication, Muslims in the West will quickly find themselves between one of two choices. They either apostatize or they immigrate to the Islamic State and thereby escape persecution from the Crusader governments and citizens. And then coming back to this analyst who works at the Institute for the Study of War, she says the group calculates that a small number of attackers can profoundly shift the way that European society views its 44 million Muslim members. And as a result, the way European Muslims view themselves. Well, they're right about that. It just takes a small number of attackers. And look at how profound the shift can be in the way Europe views the immigration problem or its Muslim population. 44 million Muslims on European soil. It says, through this provocation, it seeks to set conditions for an apocalyptic war with the West. That's what it's building toward. We went through this yesterday. Finally, this article says, the Paris attacks will surely prompt an anti-Muslim backlash. The continuing influx of hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa creates a perfect environment for the Islamic State's campaign. See, it really does suit the Islamic State's campaign. It really does. All of this is just falling right in line with what Bible prophecy says will happen. One last crusade. One spectacular clash that triggers World War III. I just want to conclude with a couple of pieces about the UK. Which, if you've been reading some of the UK publications, you've seen where they have foiled a number of attacks just in the last few months. This from The Telegraph, November 15. There are respects in which France's plight is worse than Britain's. It has many more Muslims. Its second city, Marseille, now has a Muslim majority, and they are perhaps more ghettoized than ours. It has land borders, and we do not. It's part of the Schengen passport-free area, and we are not. It insists on secularism almost as the definition of citizenship, and we do not. But the similarities are much greater than the differences, and there's no solid reason why attacks just as terrible as those in Paris will not take place in London or Manchester or Birmingham. He says here later on, what brings it all home, literally, is immigration. Even if it's true, as it probably is, that the great majority of Muslims are as peace-loving and decent as any other group of people, you have a simple problem of numbers. If a million Muslims, thanks to Angela Merkel's policy, are reaching Germany this year, and even if only 1% of them subscribe to the doctrines of ISIS, that still means 10,000 people dedicated to killing their hosts and assailing the society that accommodates them. He says here, this grim fact, or rather the grim fact, is that we have within our midst thousands of people whose lives are devoted to doing our society harm and tens of thousands more who are susceptible to the lies they tell. Yet still our policies magnify their voices and swell their numbers. There's another piece in The Telegraph that talked about, well, I think I alluded to it a moment ago, Britain foiling 7 terror attacks in just 6 months, just the past 6 months. According to the Prime Minister, They were smaller scale than what happened Friday night. But still, what happened there could happen in London. It could happen in Manchester. It could happen in Birmingham. This last piece that I'll refer to here in this segment, this just really makes you shake your head. It's from The Times. It says, only 3 extremists are subject to anti-terrorism curfews and control measures in Britain, even though almost 400 people have returned from fighting violent jihad in Syria. 400 have returned. They've gone off to fight against the West, to bring down the West, to bring down Western institutions. And then they've returned to the UK. And only three of them are subject to anti-terrorism curfews and controls. The hundreds of returning jihadists, it says, most of them young men trained by Islamic State and previously unknown to the intelligence services, have swelled the numbers of MI5's national security watch list to 3,000. So France is watching 10,000. The UK is watching 3,000. The demands of monitoring the growing number of potential terrorists is the main factor behind the government's plan to recruit 1,900 new spies. A 15% increase. France is doing it. Germany's doing it. The UK is doing it. Well, they've got to hire thousands of people just to track their movements, just to track these people on their own soil. Official estimates put the number of Britons who have gone to fight in Syria at 750, with half believed to have come back. Half of them are back. 350, 400. Efforts are made to question every returning fighter at ports and airports under counterterrorism powers. Some are arrested and charged, and a number have been jailed. Others have been assessed and as not posing an immediate threat. As if going off to Syria and killing Yazidis, killing Christians, and working to bring down the West is not seen as a threat. It says, finally, some returning fighters are checked occasionally. Others might be visited more regularly, and a few might be approached to become informants. Others seem to be more active in extremist circles will be subject to closer scrutiny, often by covert electronic means. Only those suspected of actively planning an attack are subject to round-the-clock monitoring, which involves electronic monitoring and physical surveillance by officers from the police or MI5. So they go off and fight against the West, presumably kill women and children, rape them, and then, I guess, return to their comfortable flat in Birmingham or wherever they live. And some of them not even really tracked if they're not deemed to be an immediate threat. Isn't it just a matter of time before the UK gets hit? And how hard will that hit be? Well, we'll see. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. Don't forget to send us your feedback to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
The UK program that played on TV here this past weekend and ended up generating the ninth highest response this year, which, as I told some of our operators, was really not too bad considering we got off to a pretty slow start on Saturday morning with, I think, everyone in the UK pretty much glued to their TVs, probably not watching the Key of David, but rather the BBC or Sky News after that massacre late Friday night. In any event, we did get a handful of calls Saturday morning, and then Sunday was quite strong when the program played on the other stations that we have here in the UK. The program was Does God Exist? It advertised the booklet that goes by that same title, as well as our awesome universe potential. And all total, we had 152 total requests for those two booklets. That would be, as I say, the ninth highest response for the year. In addition, with the trickle-in from last week's show, that moved, as I suggested it probably would, that repeat, which advertised Mystery of the Ages and Malachi's message to God's church today, that moved that up to the third highest response that we've had for the year, a total of 188 requests for Malachi's message and for Mystery of the Ages, the program being The Mystery Should Be Finished. Now, as far as what's upcoming this weekend, we're playing a program on the Holy Roman Empire, or one that goes through Revelation 17. It talks about, I think the title that we gave to it was Herbert Armstrong's Signature Prophecy. That one is a study through Revelation 17, and also quite a few news bits that we incorporated into it. That'll be posted, by the way, at thetrumpet.com, probably in the next day or two, so that you can view it anywhere in the world if you have access to the Trumpet website. In any event, it plays here this weekend, and it advertises the Holy Roman Empire in prophecy for the first time, Brad McDonald's new book. Also, we'll be advertising the booklet by Mr. Armstrong, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? So because of the literature offer there, I think we're all expecting a big response for this weekend's program. Before we conclude with a couple more news items, I'll just give you one email response that we got, a really good one, as you'll see here. This comes to us from Adelaide, Australia. And this individual says, "Thank you so much for today's broadcast." He's writing in response to the one we had yesterday that talked about the Paris attacks. He says, "I had been waiting all weekend for this. The church is doing remarkable work, having the website updated over the weekend with Brad McDonald's article in prime spot. And with today's broadcast, we get God's view on the Paris attacks faster than ever before." It says, "Before KPCG, I would listen to the BBC World Service most nights, keeping my ears open for the occasional story related to God's prophecies. But now I get the news that matters, Monday through Friday, live," he said. "KPCG has changed my life. It's changed my life. It allows me to get even closer to God's work. There's nothing better, after a day of dealing with the trials of this world, to hear God's servants talk about the day's news and teach us life lessons from God's word. I'm still astonished how these prophecies, which I've known about for over 20 years, thanks to the PCG, prophecies that are taking shape before my eyes. I shouldn't be surprised or astonished, but I can't believe what I'm seeing. Europe can't take this much longer." I think there's a lot of us that can identify with this man's sentiment. He says, "I can't believe I've been allowed to know God's truth. I'm not part of the church, but I know it's the truth." And then he says here, "Finally, for your information, I listen live via KPCG website at 11:30 p.m. in Adelaide, Australia." So he tunes in live late at night in most cases. He says here, "If I miss a show, I listen via Apple Podcast, the app, or if not, I upload it in time. Or if I don't upload it in time, I'll try the KPCG website. I find archive shows are uploaded quicker here. If I'm on the go, I listen live via the TuneIn app." He says, "Finally, keep up the great work." So there's a listener in Adelaide who pretty much uses just about every option we make available, whether it's the podcast from iTunes or the live broadcast on the TuneIn app on your phone or handheld device, or listening just from the KPCG website live to the stream, or, of course, getting those podcasts later from the website itself. TuneIn, by the way, has, I think, 540 followers the last time I checked. So the numbers are increasing. May 5th was the day we kicked it all off, if you remember. We've basically only got a half of a year under our belts. And look at what's been happening, as I say. Well, a couple more pieces that we can get through, hopefully. We're about out of time. But this from Victor Davis Hanson, waging the war on terror, Vichy style. He says, "A few hours before the catastrophic attack in Paris, President Obama had announced that ISIS was now contained. a recalibration of his earlier assessments of on the run and JVs from a few years back. It says, in the hours following the attack of jihadist suicide bombers and mass murderers in Paris, the Western press talked of the scourge of terrorism and extremist violence. Who were these terrorists and generic extremists who slaughtered the innocent in Paris? Were they anti-abortionists, Klansmen, Tea Party zealots? Middle Eastern websites may be crowing over the jihadist rampage and promising more to come, but this past week in the United States, we are obsessed over a yuppie son of a multimillionaire showboating his pseudo-grievances by means of a psychodramatic hunger strike at the University of Missouri, and a crowd of crybaby would-be fascists at Yale bullying a wimpy teacher over supposedly hurtful Halloween costumes. I guess that is the contemporary American version of Verdun and the Battle of the Bulge. Kind of puts things in perspective, doesn't it? This massacre and the kinds of things that, the kinds of grievances that some of the youth in America have. This sickness, he says, in the West manifests itself in a variety of creepy ways. To hide bothersome reality by inventing euphemisms and idiocies like workplace violence and largely secular, jailing a right-wing video maker rather than focusing on jihadist killers in Benghazi, deifying a grade school poseur inventor who repackaged a Radio Shack clock and wound up winning an invitation to the White House. It's quite a sickness. Just going back to what I said there in the first segment, Daniel 11, verse 40. The United States is not even mentioned. If you look at that prophecy in Isaiah 1, you see that the sickness, it's so thorough. It's from head to toe. It covers every aspect of our society, from the top on down. Read it, study it on your own time, Isaiah 1. Verse 5 in particular, but the whole chapter. And then again, just keep in mind that prophecy, that clash, triggering World War III, and the United States not even mentioned. Well, this last piece that I have here, to finish on just more of a positive note, it's by this gal, Eva Moskowitz, I guess is how you pronounce her name. She wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal. She's the founder and chief executive officer of Success Academy Charter Schools, and these are schools that have had quite a lot of success in turning out well-educated, well-adjusted young people. But she's attracted some critics as well because of what some would say her strict policies. Well, she says in this article how she attributes her success to the approach that an educator named Paul Fucaloro gave to her back in, well, I don't know if she gives dates in this piece. She writes here, when I founded Success Academy in 2006, I hired Paul to coach our teachers. I soon learned that while he was quite instructionally sophisticated, Paul was decidedly old school on the topic of student behavior. Every child had to sit up straight and show he was paying attention. I wasn't completely sold on Paul's approach at first, but when one of our schools was having trouble, I'd dispatch him to help. He'd tell the teachers to give him a class full of all the kids who had the worst behavioral and academic problems. The teachers thought this was nuts, but they went ahead and did it. And a few days later, they'd drop by Paul's classroom and find these students acting so differently that they were nearly unrecognizable. Within weeks, the students would make months' worth of academic progress Teachers couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. But Paul did it over and over again. And incredibly, the kids seemed to love Paul more than the teachers, who were far less strict. So what did he do? Well, imagine that a man to whom you're speaking at a party is looking over your shoulder. You'll suspect he isn't really listening. The same is true of kids. Their physical behavior reflects their mental state. Therefore, Paul set behavioral expectations to reflect the mental state he insisted his students have. Paul's students had to sit with hands clasped and look at whomever was speaking, called tracking. They couldn't stare off into space, play with objects, rest their head on their hands in boredom, or act like what Paul called sourpusses, who brought an attitude of negativity or indifference to the classroom. Paul made students demonstrate to him that at every single moment, they were focused on learning. And she talks about the results that came from this approach. Critics, of course, found the approach rigid, overbearing. This woman says two of her critics are living in her own house, her children, who sometimes complain that it's difficult, that they got in trouble because they weren't tracking the speaker. Maybe so, she says, but sometimes when kids look like they're daydreaming, it's because they are, and we can't allow that possibility. Finally, it says, as Paul repeatedly preached to me, it's morally wrong to let a child choose whether to pay attention, because many will make the wrong choice, and we can't let them slip through the cracks. So if a student had trouble paying attention, he'd move him to the front of the class, call his parents, keep him after school to practice, whatever it took. Paul was relentless. Finally, it says, some critics say that it's hard for young children to focus. That's true. But it's our job to teach them this. Recently, I was at a news conference at which I was asked why success has strict rules regarding behavior. As I answered, the reporters didn't stare off into space, look bored, or fiddle with things, because they were focusing. A school that fails to teach students this necessary skill isn't doing right by them. Such a necessary and fundamental skill. It makes you wonder, given what Victor Davis Hanson said in his piece, all the nonsense going on in the United States, in the academy, in the universities. How much different would it be if some of those troublemakers would have been sent to the front of the class in one of Paul's classrooms years ago? Or better yet, how much different it might be, as I mentioned last week, if they would have been brought up the right way in the home, even before they get to grade school, even before they go off to kindergarten. What a difference. Doesn't it get back to teaching, training, parental responsibility, discipline, authority, structure? Well, I had more in here in my notes on some of those themes, and perhaps we can get into it at another time. But as far as this program goes, we are about out of time. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream, of course, is available at kpcg.fm. Don't forget to send us your feedback, like that wonderful email that we got from Adelaide, Australia, and tell us where you listen and how you listen. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.